afternoon, United States v. Hinojosa et al. Mr. Stapleton?
Yes, Your Honor.
I please the court, Ed Stapleton for Juan Pablo Hinojosa. I'd like to address the speedy trial issue under the Sixth Amendment and the speedy trial motion. I had commonly called that post-indictment, but in fact, both in the language of the amendment and in case law, it's actually the right goes to the accused. And in this case, I believe there's going to be a dispute as to when Mr. Hinojosa was actually accused. The crime was committed back in 2003, and he had left the country but then had been arrested. And I was the court-appointed trial lawyer, so the facts are familiar to me on that basis. But then in May of 2006, he was in state custody, and the federal investigators came. They take him out of his cell, take him to a separate location. They began an interrogation on him. Then later, they elicit a confession. Later, they read him his rights and then take him back. And we would urge that that was, in fact, a federal arrest at that time, that he was under arrest. The government apparently takes a position that he was not actually arrested until after the indictment. But we had a motion to suppress. The court found a custodial interrogation and suppressed the confession. And so we would urge that, as far as considering time, that we really begin in May of 2006. The indictment was over 10 months later, March of 2007. And under the Marion case, the language is not based on the indictment, but the actual restraints imposed by the arrest. I was appointed midstream. There was other counsel who withdrew from the case. And when I was appointed, I filed a motion for speedy trial. That was March 2009. And we, from then that period forward, objected to any kind of continuance on the case. In July of 2009, the motion for speedy trial was denied. And however, we still did not go to trial until August 10th of 2010. What I would urge under Barco versus Wingo, that in fact there was no good reason for the delay on it, and I would suggest that the reason the government delayed the case was basically they had, in the form of the indictment they had, they'd bit off more than they could chew and still give individual people their rights. This was five murders. My client had no contact with any but the first, and so basically what they did was they tried to tie so many different incidents together that was causing delay after delay after delay in the case. And we did have the hearing on the delay, and basically the judge took the position, in part, he gave other reasons, but in part because of the filing of motions. Under Barco versus Wingo, I have to file the motion for speedy trial, or I don't take the position that we have a right to a speedy trial. But the other part of that then we're taxed in saying, well, you have now, under the Speedy Trial Act, you've taken an action that keeps you from tolling the speedy trial. We believe that we were harmed. We've outlined, and in his testimony talked about missing witnesses and time that was delayed. We had one of the issue was his involvement with the Texas Syndicate, and I think the primary evidence is that his attempts to get out of the Texas Syndicate, but for instance, the jailer who had assisted him with that had during the course of the delay been fired and apparently prosecuted, and in my ability was no longer available. So we would urge that as the primary issue in this case and ask the court grant us relief under speedy trial.
Thank you. Mr. Sullivan?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, Your Honor.
May it please the court, Scott Sullivan appearing on behalf of Mr. Raul Galindo. In light of the fact that the other two attorneys are addressing speedy trial, and in light of the fact that my client stands alone with respect to a separate murder in this case, more specifically the murder of a man named whose nickname was Mars, I will speak to that separate two count that applied to Mr. Galindo. Specific to this case is the legal requirements of the Vicar statute rather than the RICO statute. I apologize if I mispronounce it. It's section 1959. Our allegation is that because of the distinct and strong problems with the evidence, the government was unable to show a purpose for these murders and likewise establish that they were done as part of a continuing enterprise as required by the Vicar statute. It is specific to note that a mere murder done in furtherance of a enterprise would not put it within inside the statute. Rather, there must be this common purpose, and that it would have to be done upon that purpose. What happened in this case that causes problems for the government is that each of these witnesses that testified against Mr. Galindo were fellow Texas Syndicate gang members. And all of them told quite a different story. For instance, some of them stated that the reason for the killings was pride. Others testified the reasons for the killings were, the killing rather was to prevent him from not only testifying, but also they believed he had become dishonored the gang, this prison gang. Another possibility was that it was his intent to move up in gang membership. But what starts to become clear through this evidence is none of these prison gang members ever get their stories anything close to being similar. What you end up with is a myriad of different stories as to perhaps why this happened. Therefore, the government was unable to establish that there was a purpose for these murders. It's important to note that they can establish, and they do indeed establish, that perhaps this is a murder case. All of the testimony and all of the evidence does point toward Mr. Galindo.
So are you saying that if you have witnesses who tell different stories, the jury can't sort that out and ultimately come out a particular way? I mean, do all the witnesses have to be consistent to convict?
I think it's not a matter of consistency, I would submit, Your Honor. I would submit that what happened in this case is the purpose starts to become unclear through the evidence. And that's one of the reasons we are saying he did commit the murder, a vicious murder, obviously, Your Honor. They killed and burned this man. But the difficulty in showing that further step beyond a reasonable doubt that there has to be a purpose wasn't just merely inconsistencies, but rather gang members coming up with their stories as they go along. One man even announced to the whole court, this will set me free. And you had these...
that goes to credibility.
I don't think it's...
Having a motive to lie on the stand or to shade your testimony so you get consideration on your own sentence is quintessential impeachment evidence, but the jury can still find somebody credible who has every incentive to lie.
And I agree that the problem becomes, though, Your Honor, is that under the Vicar statute, how far they have to go. And indeed, we could sort out these inconsistencies and say there's still murder. But what we can't do is sort out the inconsistencies and find a purpose in moving up in membership as required by the Vicar statute. Rather, they can't show any integral reason for this being integral to membership and his ongoing membership in the Texas Syndicate gang. And if the court does not have any more questions for me, I will say give the 20 seconds back and save the remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Is it Freesell?
Freesell, Your Honor. John Frisell for...
I should know that by now.
It's all right. John Frisell for Mr. Armando Garcia. May it please the court. I was going to focus on on the Sixth Amendment cross-examination issue that was raised in issue number 3 of the brief. A highly disputed issue during the trial was Mr. Armando Garcia's intent, if he actually intended by shooting Moran to kill him, or whether he believed Moran was already dead. And that was a material element of both the counts he was convicted of, count 1 and count 5, under RICO and Section 1959. And this occurred because the government, to prove the intent, offered as a witness a United States attorney who had actually prosecuted Mr. Armando Garcia for the very murder that was one of these predicate acts in this case. So the murder that was being contested as far as Mr. Armando Garcia's intent, the government put on the witness stand an assistant United States attorney who had been a district attorney who prosecuted Mr. Armando Garcia for the same offense. When the defense counsel tried to cross-examine as to the motive of why Mr. Garcia might have entered a guilty plea, a motive that would contest the inference that he entered a guilty plea because he actually was in fact guilty and had committed each element of the offense, but rather the motive was because he had nothing to lose because he was getting a concurrent sentence with another case, the court would not allow the defense to go into that, and this denied evidence in front of the jury as to the fact that by pleading guilty he was not facing a potential state sentence of 99 years, that he was not subjecting himself to any more time than he's already serving. And that,
but what was the specific question that was not, there was a question and then there was an objection, there was a discussion and the judge basically said rephrase and there was a rephrasing and then there was an answer. So where is the error here that's been preserved that was brought to the district court's attention?
Well, my position here is that it was preserved because under Rule of Evidence 103A, the context was apparent because the defense lawyer, the first question was about the possible motives of prosecution and defendants to enter plea agreements. They then approached the bench, and when he rephrased the question, defense counsel phrased it as, is it common practice to enter plea agreements with concurrent sentences? So it appears from the judge's ruling that the defense counsel didn't even go into the issue of motive to enter a plea.
But where is a question that wasn't allowed to be answered? I mean, we have the question, we have the objection, then we have the rephrasing about the common practice, and then that's it. So where is it that, I mean, typically, if the judge says rephrase, and you rephrase, but you still have more questions, well, you ask them, and then the judge can sustain or overrule an objection if there is one. So I'm having trouble understanding where there's an error, whether or not the error is, you know, whether there's, where there is an event that could be an error. Maybe that's what I'm asking.
Right, and I understand. And when the question was first asked about the motive, the judge was very explicit about that's not relevant here. The only thing that's relevant is the conviction. And that's when they approached the bench, and he kept telling the lawyers that this is not relevant. When they returned, he asked the one question, but if he had been allowed to continue, he could have drawn that out a bit as to why people do enter plea agreements that may not reflect actual guilt, but an agreement for time served or concurrent sentences.
Thank you. Mr. Brown?
May it please the court, my name is Bill Brown, representing the United States in this appeal. I did not participate in the district court case. I'm from Washington, handling it on appeal only. Starting with the last issue that was raised by Mr. Garcia, I believe the court is correct that there was no actual restriction of the questioning. If the court had ruled that you cannot go into concurrent sentences and excluded that testimony, that would have been an issue, and the only question would have been whether or not that was an error and whether it was harmless. But that's not what happened. Here, before the objection even came in, the defense brought out that there was a question, was there a concurrent sentence agreement to run these cases together? Is that right? And the witness said it was. And the questioning, would you agree that there's also a consideration of other cases be taken into account? Is that right? Yes. And then it also brought out that there was a concurrent sentence in this particular agreement. And then in conclusion, asked Ms. Leo, is it common practice amongst lawyers, defense lawyers, and prosecutors in state court in order to resolve cases, to bring closure to cases, to enter into agreements where there is concurrent sentences and cases to be considered as part of the overall package just to bring the case to an end? The answer was yes. And I would like to go, in the defendant's brief, I believe there's a suggestion that he was somehow foreclosed from arguing this point to the jury. But as we point out in our brief, he very specifically did argue the point to the jury and pointed to the state court judgment where it says concurrent sentences, and this is a quote from closing, and Ms. Leo testified under cross-examination that the reason for concurrent sentences was so that those sentences could run together with the underlying charge. Basically, this conviction was going to wash itself out because it was going to be eaten up by other cases that Mr. Garcia was doing time for. That's the reason he pled guilty. So he was able to ask the questions. He was able to make the argument. I do not believe that there was a preserved error to the extent there was anything that he wanted to get out that he wasn't not able to do so. He did not make that clear to the district court. And more importantly, the gist of it was presented to the court and to the jury. And if there was something else that was left out, it would have been harmless in light of the overall evidence that he committed this murder. Turning to the Mr. Hinojosa's speedy trial claim, he suggests that he went into custody in May 2006 because he was questioned by federal agents. At that time, he was in custody on charged with a murder, and he was not brought into federal custody until a month after the indictment in 2007. The defendant mentions that the government delayed the trial after the indictment was returned. I think it's clear from the hearing and the motions that the delays were brought about by the defendants, including the defendant Hinojosa, who up for at least a year and a half filed motions to delay the trial in the interest of justice and other motions. The defendant here on appeal has raised the point that the filing of a speedy trial motion was sufficient, is tolls the Speedy Trial Act. And while that is probably true, there's a Ninth Circuit case that says that a speedy trial motion is just like any other motion and it tolls the Speedy Trial Act. That really isn't of any significance here because during the whole period when his Speedy Trial Act motion was pending, there were other motions pending, such as his motion to suppress. So even if it had never been filed, it wouldn't have had any effect on the running of the Speedy Trial Act. He mentions Mr. Buentello, who was a Texas Department of Corrections employee, that he hadn't been able to get some information from him. As I understand it, what he was looking for was some sort of evidence from the Texas Department of Corrections of his participation back before all these events happened in a program to get out of the gang. Doesn't mean he got out of the gang or he was just participated in the program. And apparently his subpoena to the to Texas Department of Corrections didn't come up with the information he wanted. And this fella who was back in 2002 was involved in that was no longer available. There was no showing that he had these records. These were Texas Department of Corrections records. And the main point that the judge found significant on that particular point was that there was no showing that he had become unavailable during any particular time. As the record shows, after the 2003 murder, basically for 3 years he was on the run. He went to Mexico and then returned several years later to Alabama. But he didn't turn himself in, even though he knew there was a warrant, a Texas state warrant for his arrest. Turning last to the Mr. Galindo's Vicar conviction, I would dispute a bit that the evidence is totally conflicting or there's all these different stories as to Mr. Galindo's motivation. The motivation was very clear from all the witnesses. They found out that Mars was an informant and he had to be killed. And they killed him. And as to his personal motivation, Mr. Galindo was...
Were the people in that lawyer's office prosecuted?
I don't know, Your Honor. I wasn't involved in the district court, like I said, and I just don't know what the fallout in other investigations was.
Because that seems like a fairly serious event that occurred there, the legal assistant telling them that this guy's there to be a snitch.
It does indeed.
Yeah, okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I just don't know.
Okay.
And Mr. Galindo volunteered or was ordered to perform the hit. And as far as maintaining your purpose, as the prosecutor pointed out to the judge at trial, it was very clear that if you were ordered to perform a hit or volunteer to do so and didn't do so, you would not only lose stature in the gang, you might be killed. So that in and of itself shows that he was doing it to maintain, that he performed the hit for the purpose of maintaining his position. But there was also a clear, he stated to the his co-conspirators in the hit that he did it because the fellow was a snitch and because he was going to testify against the other Texas Syndicate members, and that he wanted to do it to increase his stature in the gang. That's not different from saying he did it because he's a snitch and because he wants to, and that the hitter wants to increase his stature in the gang. Aren't different motives. It's all the same plan. It's not like he had another motive that was like he was angry at him for stealing money or killing or for playing around with a girlfriend. This was all the purpose of this, came out of the snitch thing. And the Wilson case makes it clear that under the Vicar statute that the purpose of maintaining and increasing your role in the conspiracy doesn't have to be the sole purpose. It just has to be a purpose, and it has to be integral to the operation of the gang. And that's certainly true here, since this all grew out of the effort to assist the gang. And he also, of course, had the purpose of keeping him from testifying, which accomplishes the same thing, and was the although another purpose was sufficient to support the obstruction count. If there are no questions.
That's fine. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Stapleton?
Yes, Your Honor. Just to answer your question, that the paralegal was prosecuted and that went on, entered a plea during the course of the case. Let me just say that whether we're talking about a time of 3 years between indictment and trial in this case,
or a time of 4 years from the investigation to the trial of this case. I would urge that we still meet the first, and I'm making reference really to this court's decision in Molina Saladio in 2009, with the meeting the standards on the first three elements of Barker v. Wingo, the prejudice then is assumed, or that's my understanding of it, and that these times are so long compared to other cases. Hargett, Molina Saladio was 10 years, but the remainder of the cases, Barker v. Wingo itself was just a year, and the Hargett case was 3 months. We're dealing with an extremely long time for the trial. And now there may have been a sense, well, Mr. Hinojosa is in so much trouble otherwise that it doesn't matter how long he stays, but it was continually a great concern. As far as the time that he originally raised it, I'm not sure why it was not raised before I was involved in the case, but he was adamant at every time he addressed the court that he wanted a speedy trial in the case because he thought he was going to be acquitted. He has maintained afterwards that he did not kill Big Mike, so he wanted his trial. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Sullivan?
Just to clarify one matter so that I agree with the prosecution that the Wilson case does control in this case. And I certainly concur also that the paralegal needed to be prosecuted. I would submit to the court one last idea with respect to all of this, and that is it was just more than mere inconsistencies or mere impeachment. For instance, one of these witnesses theorized that, and it sounds crazy, but it's probably the truth, that if they didn't do this, the Zetas would get in a gangland warfare with everybody. From my perspective, that is a clear showing that it was not done in furtherance of gang membership. And what I'm referring to is one of the witnesses got on the stand and said something to the effect that if he had not killed him, then the Zetas, we would have had a huge warfare in the valley between the Zetas, a paramilitary gang force in Mexico, against the Texas Syndicate. I would submit to the court that that isn't just impeachment, that isn't just an inconsistency, that was one of their profound theories as to why he did this. I would submit to the court that is in no way an integral part of his gang membership. And with that, if the court has any more questions, I'll be seated.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Friesel.
In response to the government's first argument regarding preservation of error, when the first question that the defense counsel at trial asked was, what is the motive that the defense would have for negotiating a plea agreement for a case that would run concurrent to other cases? The judge sustained an objection, stated that was irrelevant. When defense counsel tried to rephrase it, the court sustained the objection again. They then approached the bench. There was a discussion, and when that bench conference was over, the judge said he would allow defense counsel to rephrase that question, but he reiterated that the issue was irrelevant. He didn't care how long it took. When defense counsel said, if this won't take long, he reiterated, I don't care how long it takes, it's irrelevant, which...
But he let him ask the question.
Well, it did let him ask the one question, but the issue then becomes, it limited the amount of information he was able to draw out of this witness regarding the possible motives, and whether if he had been allowed to continue along that line, he would have been able to develop more evidence on that issue.
Well, when he pled guilty, didn't he say, I'm pleading guilty because I am guilty and for no other reason? I mean, don't they say that in every single guilty plea?
Well, yes.
So isn't he going against his own plea that way anyway? I mean, it seems like you got into the motive more than is appropriate, frankly.
Well, the even the federal rules of evidence recognize that in certain circumstances the motive for a plea are relevant and need to be allowed to go, that the defendant needs to be allowed to go into it, and the advisory notes as cited in the brief discuss that, that in some cases there may be a motive beyond true guilt or innocence, and this is a case where because of the concurrent sentence, I make the point that that should have applied here, and the motive, possible motive, should have been allowed to have gone into that. Thank you.
Thank you. All three of you are court appointed.
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah,
we appreciate your services very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much.